Hello, and welcome to the very first edition of Ungagged Film Club. This month, since it's Pride Month, it seemed only appropriate that we'd watch the film Pride, which was made in 2014, directed by Matthew Warkas and written by Stephen Beresford. It's the story of the founding of LGSM, Lesbian and Gay Support the Minors. It's set between the Pride marches of 1984 and 1985 and tells the story of LGSM and the support it gave to a minor community in Wales. I love this film. It's one of my favourites. I feel as if I should list the stars, but there are actually so many. It's such an ensemble cast. And you've got Ben Schnetzer that plays Mark Ashton, Joseph Gilgan, Faye Marcy, Dominic West, Andrew Scott, Freddie Fox, George McKay, Imelda Staunton, Jessica Gunning, Mena Trussler, Bill Nye, and of course the great Paddy Considine. Joining me today, I'll be your host, David McClement, transmitting as usual from the Blantyre Free State. You'll be familiar with a couple of the contributors that will be joining me today. It's Brian Stewart Finlay and Deborah Torrance. Regular listeners to Holyrood Ungagged will know exactly who they are, but we're also joined by Rachel Horowitz for the first time, a fellow member of the Ungagged Collective. And with further ado, let's get the club going.
The overture. Let's go!
Oh, LGSM. What does that stand for, then?
I'm a woman, Mike, okay? I'm also a lesbian and a feminist.
Listen, love, I don't care if you're Arthur Scargill. Don't talk during the big go.
Tickety-boo, 62.
Okay, welcome everybody. We're here to talk about the movie Pride because it's June, which means it's Pride Month, so it seemed like an easy decision on what film to pick. I'll just start off to say I absolutely love this film. It's one of those films that if it's on TV, if I was flicking through the channels, if I catch it, I'm probably stuck there until it's finished. There are so many fantastic scenes. I often go onto YouTube and I'll just, you know, randomly watch some of the scenes because there are so many. I actually at one point tried to write my favourite scene and I got to the bottom of the paper and my notepad and I was still remembering other scenes. So I think I wrote them at 9 scenes and I've still no scratched the surface because there's just so many absolutely brilliant scenes. Some of it's so funny. But when I was looking at my favourite scenes, it's actually quite sort of moving and touching scenes. For a comedy, that's not it's not the comedy that sticks with me. It's more of the sort of the heart of the movie. So just if we just go around everybody and get your initial thoughts and feelings in the movie. Deborah?
Well, it's a wonderful movie. I don't know how else to describe it. It's got so much, hasn't it? There's so many layers. And like you say, there's so many funny bits, but then almost immediately after, there's some really solemn, somber moments that really you can't help but cry, in my opinion. When you asked me to watch this, David, I watched it as soon as you said, because it is, as you say, a great movie. It's one of my favourites as well. And I watched it and I kept crying. I cried so much and I was so mad at you making me watch it. But I watched it again this afternoon and it was really joyful. Like, really enjoyed the solidarity, I think you should probably say there's going to be spoilers in this, isn't there?
Oh yeah, definitely. If anybody was listening to this with the idea that they were trying to decide whether to watch it, all I can say is yes, watch it, but maybe stop the podcasting out and come back once you've actually watched it.
Yes. Some of my favourite bits are just one-liners that they come away with. And there's a great scene where they're at the actual main fundraiser portion and there's a drag queen who's dressed as Martha Cargill. Like, you could just overlook that because there's no like big hullabaloo about it. It's just the photographer going around and there's Martha Cargill and a drag queen. It was just wee bits like that. It's a real gem of a movie.
Yeah, that was actually one of the things that I noticed when I was watching it again last night. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen this movie and I still saw new things that I'd never noticed before. And that was one of them. Another thing I noticed was the theatre company that's advertising the side of the bus is the logo for the movie. I'd never seen that before.
Nice spot.
Rachel, I believe this is the first time you had seen it when you watched it from the film club.
I think this was the first time I've seen it before. And I kind of like, you know, it was kind of moving, like especially like sort of as a obviously BT person like myself, and like growing up in a time when, you know, I think I kind of grew up in the last days of sort of Section 28 and that. And it was really, I just kind of thought as I was watching it, I kind of thought, like, you know, kind of sad, because it's like I kept thinking, like, would a movie like this be made now? Like, would people be brave enough, like, to make this now? And like, from only 5 years ago, I don't know. But I really liked the especially seeing what happened to all of them at the end. I think I got a bit tearful, especially with that one. I think his name was Mark Ashton, who like died of AIDS, and he was only like 26 or something. And that was really sad. But I mean, I think, like, although it was a comedy, it was very like true to life, and I felt like none of the characters were, because sometimes you watch films and, like, you know, the bad guys are like all like a bit simplistic and stuff, and I didn't really find that with this film. Like, even the person that, like I think her name was Maureen, who like grasped them all up to the papers, you can kind of even not agree with it, but like I can, you know, you can kind of understand it. They were all portrayed very, like, very realistically, rather than just being like all one-sided, and I really love that.
Very, very well-rounded characters, I thought.
Multi-dimensional, like you say, really relatable, real people. It was great characterization.
Especially in a kind of LGBT sort of film, it'd be quite easy for, like, to have like a collection of sort of different gay stereotypes. Like, this is the flamboyant one, this is the muscly one. You know, like, they managed to stay clear of that sort of cliches. Brian, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, so this is also one of my favourite films, but I hadn't actually watched it for quite some time. And when we decided to do it for the film club, I was kind of going back. I don't know exactly the last time I would have watched it, but it's a good couple of years ago anyway. And I think it was good going back and watching it again, obviously, for a reminder of just how good the film is and how complex and dynamic a lot of the different parts of the film are, but also to view it in the context of how things are for queer people just now. And I think that you can actually make some comparisons to the debate around trans people, because I know that sort of queer liberation in the 1980s was very much centred around cis individuals and around particularly people that were just identifying as gay or as lesbian. And it's interesting to see those words take dominance, and we can see how that's developed and moved on, but also seeing the slight divisions within the group. So one of my favourite scenes is the one that I know that's in one of the clips that you've chosen, is when they're talking about they want to do the feminist days discussion. I love that little scene because it's really funny, but it's actually really quite interesting that they've included that, because the trade union movement and gay liberation were known for being quite male dominated. And I think that it's good that they sort of introduce that into the discussion, but they do it in such a way that's comical and funny, with the women turning around and talking about the bingo. And you can see that the groups do split because these two characters disappear, but they come together at the end. And I think that what needs to happen, particularly in the context of trans rights at the moment, is that all queer people need to be united and fight for everybody. So I just think that was one of the things that I took away watching it in the context of what's happening today.
That scene we're talking about, it's funny because when Rachel was watching the film today, she messaged me saying, I don't care if you're Arthur Cargill, there's no talking during the bingo, honey. And it was brilliant. I resisted doing a Welsh accent there.
There is so many memorable lines like that. One of my favourites is towards the end when the wee older lady gets out of the van and she goes, where are my lesbians?
Yes, yeah. And it's great because I think that some older people that don't necessarily relate as queer often come out with these sort of one-liners, and it just seems so funny and comical. You know, being grown up and going to Funny Girls in Blackpool quite a lot, which is got a lot of older people that go to it. obviously heterosexual older people, and they love it, and they come out with all these types of phrases, and it's great, and it's, you know, it's a real feeling of inclusivity and feeling positive and having a laugh. I like it.
It was quite funny, you know, when the old couple, I think like Cliff and his wife, I think she's like, I've forgotten her name now, but them two were making sandwiches for the miners, and then like he suddenly goes to her and he goes like, I'm gay. She's like, yeah, I know, I've known since 1964.
That's a great scene.
That is. Bill Nighy is one of my favourite characters, that Cliff Barry. I think he plays it so well, especially in the beginning when he's introduced to them and you see that awkwardness. And I love how it's sort of portrayed as, oh, is he just being maybe a bit homophobic? And then you can see as the character develops, you can totally see what's going on, and it's just an elite, the accumulation is that scene you're talking about, which is beautiful. I love it. And he wasn't cutting the sandwiches straight.
Yeah, and I like the way they sort of like they give a lot of space in that scene. There's a lot of kind of just the wee pauses of silence, and you can kind of feel him, and then he builds it up and just kind of just goes, I'm gay. And just the sort of the way he says it as well, like that he's just kind of trying to drop it in and sort of disassociate himself right away. And the kind of look in his face as well when she says, well, I can't speak for everyone, but I've known since about 1968.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And you just see the relief and the sort of joy in his face. Yeah. It's so nice.
And then they go back to cutting sandwiches, which is also nice. Yeah. Just carry on.
And that wee bit at the end, though, when he just stops cutting for a second, just looks at her. And it just goes back, and it's just like, it's so real. It's like movies that have a bit of overblowing and over dramatizing things. Real life isn't always like that. And that was seemed much more like real life than most movies, because
it is a lot more realistic than a lot of movies. Like, and the sort of like the moments of silence that, you know, like the really awkward silences like you get in real life, like that's just, it's so, I just thought it was brilliant, really.
Yeah, so Cliff was your favourite character, Deborah?
Yeah, one of, I mean, they're all great, great characters, but I really like the way Bill Nighy plays Cliff. I think he does it so beautifully. He's a great actor anyway, but just, it was like that character was written for him.
Yeah, I think one of the characters that, I mean, like you said, there's so many characters, I struggle to say this is my favourite, but Gethin, played by Andrew Scott.
He's my favourite.
Oh, on you go, you talk about him first and I'll chip in.
I think it's because I quite relate to this character quite a bit, I think, because he's quite shy anyway, isn't he? And he's not forthcoming and things like that. But in general, obviously, when I'm around people I know and feel comfortable with, I'm quite vocal and chatty and whatnot. But when it comes to solidarity movements, I prefer to be in the background and being the one that maybe just sort of does a little bit of support, does, you know, X, Y, and Z. I don't like, I hate actually putting myself forward to do things generally. Like actually going to a political meeting on my own for the first time is a really, really big thing for me. So I think I relate to him taking a bit of a step back and you know, providing maybe a space for people to work in, be supportive and have a lot of things going on in the background. Obviously, his partner was HIV positive. He's got some hang-ups about his own sexuality and things like that. So I think I relate quite a lot to that character. And I think it's just such a warm and three-dimensional character, because it's true what you're saying. There's no stereotypes as such. And, you know, he can sometimes come across as being quite aloof when actually he's not.
Yeah, it's just Andrew Scott plays him so well. Like, he just plays him like he's like an open nerve. You can just see how much pain he's carrying with him. And it's like, I just, every time I'm watching it, I just want to give him a hug all the time, because you can just see. And then later in the movie, when he sort of, Imelda Staunton's character sort of helps him think about his mum and things like that, and he reconciles with her, and you just see the sort of weight lifted from him after that. And it's lovely to see. And again, so true to life. Like, there's no big shouting matches when he sees his mum, and it's so easy that people, you know, fall out and years suddenly fly by, and suddenly it's 16 years later, and that kind of thing happens in real life. It's not fireworks, it's just people carry these kind of weights with them their whole life at times.
I thought that was a nice scene as well at the party when he was shouting I'm gay and I'm Welsh. And it was really, it was nice. It was sort of affirming. Like, you saw that in himself. And then when he was chatting with, about his mum, and the woman said, well, what did you say to her? And I thought, it's so real. It's like, you know, how many women do you know in your community that would say something like that to you? It's like, even the language that's used, everything. And it's just, it's a brilliant film.
There's also that scene as well. It's funny when Gethin first comes to the village. And then
you
say, where are you from? He goes, oh, Rill. Originally, and you see them all changing, like, their attitude. Like, no, we're not accepting. Gays are the one thing, but we're not accepting anybody from North Wales. The thing is, I've watched that scene so many times, but I never noticed Andrew Scott before. And he looks, Gethin looks genuinely hurt, like, he, as if like, he's expecting rejection. And even though, you know, it's obviously a joke, like, they're not rejecting him because he's with the wrong bit of Wales, but he's obviously just experienced rejection that much that for that second, they just expects it to happen again. I'm a big fan of Andrew Scott. He's so good. And other characters I've seen him play are totally different from Gethin. It's like, I think the first time I saw him was in Sherlock, where he plays Moriarty. And that's like such a different character. But he just nails it. Who's not said their favourite character? Rachel, did you have a favourite?
I like Gethin as well. I'd also say, like, I did really like the older women at the Pit Village. I thought they, like, I can't actually remember. I think one of them was called, I know one of them, you know, Cliff's wife, I think she was, but also, like, the...
Melda Staunton's character.
Yeah, and also, I think, was her name, I think, Rita?
Hefina. Hefina. I don't remember hearing it in the movie, but that's what it said in IMDb.
Was she not called Hefy in the movie?
Yeah, maybe. The one, the blonde one, she was called...
Gwen.
Yeah, Gwen. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm, like, rubbish with
and
names.
And there was Shan as well.
Yeah.
Shan.
Oh, yeah, Shan was great. But also, I really liked Joe. I thought he was really, like, sweet. I kind of, like, wanted to know, because, you know, that bit at the end, maybe I missed it or something, but I don't know what happened to him in real life, like, at the end. Because he basically, like, I found it so sad, like, when his parents, like, basically sent him away.
Yeah.
When Shan turned up with a van. And I wanted to know what happened in real life. Like, was he okay?
Well, I'm just reading the wiki and it says Joe Bromley Cooper was a fictional LGSM member.
Oh, okay.
And he was meant to be the audience surrogate. So that's why he was the photographer.
Yeah, because we see him for the first time right at the start when he arrives. So he's a kind of new character that needs everything explained so that we as the audience can hear it. I did wonder that if he was a real character or not, because I know most of them are, but...
I also, like, liked Mark as well. Like, I think he kind of, like, reminded me of me when I was that age. I was like, I just thought he was, like, he was so kind of like, oh, well, you know, this is going on, let's do this. Like, you know, I just thought it was like, so great that he was, like, really, like, kind of standing up for rights and stuff, and I just, like, it really reminded me of me, like, when I was younger.
I like that scene that sort of introduced him, where it was the Thatcher out flag hanging out his flat window, and then it goes in and he's watching the news about the miners, and he's had a lumber that night,
and that communist flag and stuff.
I really like that. And then there was a great one of the thing that I found really endearing about the character is when he's at the miners club and he's been put up on the stage, and you can feel that awkwardness, like, because there was a lot of, you know, animosity from some of the miners at the time, because the gays are coming. And he really, like, when he done that joke about singing Dorothy over the rainbow. When he done that joke and it didn't land, I really felt like that. I felt that. Oh, well, fuck it, I'm here now, might as well. Thank you for having it. You know, and it was brilliant. It was just a lovely moment of showing you his, you know, character. I really liked that. I enjoyed that very much.
It's also at that point, like, he seemed so in charge of every situation at that point, even like the old guy shouting abuse at him, and he was just like, yo, I'll send the police after you. And he's like, oh, send them up. And and then with his friends, he's very much the sort of the leader, and then it gets to that and you feel the tension, mm-hmm. and then he's looking about saying, anybody else want to be the leader?
Anybody else want a shot?
and then he cracks that other joke just at the end of the speech saying, well, I mean, if one in five people are gay, then one in five minors are gay, so at least for 20% are glad to see us. joke's not going to good and well.
But the thing is, though, I found it quite interesting how, like obviously there was also a lot of hostility towards the minors, like from some gay people, which I found quite interesting. Like, you know, that at the start, that guy from, they beat me up every day at school. Yeah. And I was like, oh, I found that side of things really interesting. Like,
it was balanced. There was a balance.
Yeah. I can imagine how that actually would have like played out, especially since they're all based in London, and a lot of them might have like had bad experiences that kind of community and stuff before.
It's the sort of film that are quite easy for them just to sort of idealise the sort of working class communities struggling against the sort of Thatcher government, but it doesn't do that, you know. Like it doesn't, that character near the start does introduce you to the fact that, you know, these are communities would be particularly open to LGBT people, and yeah, it's very balanced. I think it was you that said that there, Deborah. Just thinking of any other characters, how could we not mention Jonathan, Dominic West's character? He's so over the top and a great sort of counterpart to Gethin, who's like very quiet and sort of unassuming. On the other hand, he's with Jonathan, who's so over the top and just doesn't give a fuck. And again, that's one of the best scenes. I think if you Google Pride best scene, the first one that will come up is the one of Jonathan dancing in the Miners' Welfare.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how anybody could watch that and it not bring a smile to your face. It's just, then they also like that scene.
It's a really, it's like a pause point in the film, isn't it? Because you at that point, it starts to really start to go into some of the really deep issues around the strike and the poverty that and the resistance that, you know, that the community's having to put on strike, but also, you know, the feeling and the hostility of some of these people towards the gays and lesbians who've arrived, and, you know, and that's the point where you start to see a real turning point in the relationship, I think, which is quite a really, really positive and uplifting thing. I think with Jonathan as a character too, because you don't find out until the end as well that he is also HIV positive, I think that explains a lot about his character, because he is quite a flamboyant and quite an extrovert character, but you can see that there's a real vulnerability to him as well. It's almost similar to Gethin's, where it's different, because Gethin's is obviously quite aloof and you know, quite introverted and thinking about his own problems and trying to navigate things, where you can see that Jonathan just really wants to be accepted and be himself, and it's that sort of extrovert character. So I think that, again, because
he reminds me a lot of people like when I was younger in the sort of LGBT society at uni. Like, he really reminds me of like a lot of people I knew back then.
Yeah, and ultimately these people just want to be accepted and loved, and you know, he's a performer, he does drag, he enjoys being on stage and entertaining people, but for some of these people, and I know some of these people from the past, that they can struggle to go into their normal, their day-to-day lives and be themselves and be accepted as themselves. And I think that you can see the complexities within that character, and it makes more sense at the end when you find out that, you know, when Gethin's, because he's in hospital because he's been beaten up, and says, you know, well, you need to make sure he's looking after himself, and she's like, oh yeah, I'll make sure he's okay, and you're like, no, you don't understand, you need to make sure he's eating properly. And that's where you realize, and that kind of, it's like it kind of falls into place as to why maybe Jonathan's the way he is.
Yeah, you get the impression that he's sort of running away from his own sort of, he doesn't want to face his own mortality, you know, and he has that sort of, you know, I don't care sort of persona, because he doesn't want to kind of deal with it. There's another, when you said it when being a performer, again, one of the wee moments that I noticed that I had missed previous viewings was when Di comes off stage and Jonathan says to him, oh, I've dealt with some tough crowds myself. And he says, what in politics? He says, no panto.
Just talking about Di there, I think it'd be amiss not to mention him just as a character. He's really...
I love Di. He's so lovely.
He's great, isn't he? He's like 100 men I know who's, you know, so sort of... What is the word, earnest? Like, he's just sort of really there and sort of humble and all that. And I really like the journey he goes on from starting off I like it when he turns up at the bookshop and says, oh, LGSM, what does the L stand for? And then they're inside and he's saying he thought it was London. Right to the very end, he's getting interviewed. He says something just at the end that's really profound and sort of, you know, he fully supports the gays. He's right in there. And obviously that scene when they're at Pride and the wee red bus comes up and I don't want to talk about the end yet because I think there's some other things we have to talk about, like the soundtrack. I thought...
Yes, the soundtrack. Yeah, it's so... Also, what I kept noticing, like, all the way through is, like, especially, I think, the way it was filmed as well, I kept noticing it was so, like, 1980s. Like, that, like... But also, like, the clothes that the people in the Welsh village were wearing, it really reminds me of, like, sort of some other places that I visited, like, in, you know, like, in Eastern Europe and Russia and stuff. They've got that kind of, like, the whole, like, the decor and, like, the dresses that they're wearing and, the little nightclub where, like, everyone in the village goes, like, down and has a boogie. Like, and all of these kind of like 1980s songs that they were playing, I just kind of thought, like, if you're like from a small Welsh village like that, hearing like things like Frankie Goes to Hollywood and other things that they were playing, like, it would be like such a revelation, I suppose, to them, like, back in those days.
I think I might be the only one here that really has memories of the 80s, although not that many. I do love the whole 80s aesthetic of the whole film, like the sort of London scenes or the sort of 80s. You see, like, when you watch a show about the 80s or music from the 80s, but when you go to the Welsh village, that was the 80s that I remember as a kid, because that's what everybody looked like. That was the same sort of outfits and beige and a lot of greys and things like that.
A lot of sort of cross knit sort of sweaters over polo necks and sort of slack chinos. That was the man's
the beige
attire.
Zipper.
Man at CNA, wasn't it?
Yeah, and when they go into the record label and it's the receptionist is dressed like she's in a 1980s, she looks like Samantha Fox or something, you know, that kind of like the hat with the hair, and she's been really dismissive. That's like the 1980s that you see in music videos and you know, the sort of the clubbing scene and things like that, and that's what, almost like what people want you to remember the 1980s to look like.
Yeah.
But actually, the Welsh village is very much what we would recognise from that time, and it feels like, you know, that was the really 1980s that we see. And also, what's quite true about this film, as you notice, that the working class people, obviously during the miners' strike, and I think that this is quite a good detail, is that they're always wearing the same clothes or the same jackets and stuff. Whereas for some reason in films, they just switch it up all the time without thinking. But actually, these people probably didn't have that opportunity to do that. And it was good that they had that consistently all the way through, where they're always wearing the same jackets. They're always, you know, or similar clothing all the way through. And I think that was a really good attention to detail, because props and what people are wearing in films can obviously be changed up all the time, constantly, for no real reason. But actually, there was a lot of recycling going on from scene to scene. And I think that that's a really positive thing and true to the reflection of the time.
Just talking about detail, there was a poster on the wall inside the social club that says, can you donate a winter jacket?
Yes, and I saw that. Oh, yeah, I saw that.
And I thought, that's great. And the same when they were, you know, doing the bingo and the prize was a tin of beef.
Yes. Right.
It was a great contrast, especially with the character Steph. I thought, with her, you know, really 80s punk, pink mohawk, that, you know, the whole look going on, I really like that contrast with women of the same age and, you know, the mining village. It was a great, as you say, great attention to detail.
Yeah, I'd like to go back to talking a bit more about Paddy Considine as Di, because, I mean, Paddy Considine, what an actor he is, because I'm used to it. I've seen him play like psychopath, vengeful killers. I've seen him play like hard-nosed, tough marines. I saw him play an evil paedophile priest. And then he plays Di, who's like the nicest guy in the world. I mean, he's like, it's just hard to, I suppose that's acting, isn't it? It's hard to imagine that that's the same guy and that plays some of these evil characters that then can just be so nice. And I think, again, it's probably Di's character is some of the bits that made me tear up, and I don't even know why at times. Like when he makes that speech in the gay club near the start, He's saying about when you're in a battle with somebody so much more powerful than yourself, to suddenly find out you get a friend, one that you didn't even know you had. And it's the way he takes that breath. He goes, it's the best feeling in the world. And it's just, I just tear up thinking about it. It's just so, and it's all down to how he acts it and how he delivers it. It's fantastic.
I think because there's nothing warmer than solidarity. And I think unexpected solidarity, I think, is always a really good thing. And I think for Di's character and probably the Welsh miners, because they were probably feeling quite isolated, both geographically and politically, yeah, because of what was happening. And, you know, all of a sudden they're getting this money coming through from this organisation they've never heard of before, and they don't quite understand. And that friend that they didn't know was there. And I think that's why it does make you tear up, because I think that, you know, as working class people with experiences or actually being queer people, is we can actually understand the complexities in that relationship, because it's so easy for, in working class communities, for prejudice to be there. And where this film doesn't paint it as a sort of rosy picture of class solidarity all together against the powerful, is that sort of complex relationship. And I think that we fully understand the complexities of that as individuals and as a collective, that's why it feels so overwhelming and quite teary, I think.
There's also that great scene about solidarity when Di and Mark are talking about it, when they're like walking up around the Welsh valleys. You know, and Mark talks about the fact that he's from Northern Ireland, which I think that's the only bit that really he mentions it, and about how, like, you can see why, you know, what happens when communities don't speak to each other.
Yeah.
And I suppose explains why he is willing to overlook some of the initial prejudice, because he knows, like, you know, it's more important to sort of make these deeper connections. And what I like about that scene as well is right after it, after when they're talking about this kind of solidarity in a sort of abstract sense, there's the conversation when they explain that the police are arresting sort of the miners, and then it's like real sort of like practical solidarity, because Jonathan knows all about police mm-hmm. harassment and knows
yeah.
what your rights are. So he explains that, and right away, Shan then like marches into the police station and just yes. repeats exactly what Jonathan said. Uh-huh. Only we her sort of spinning
but
it.
Yeah, the police are completely taken aback, aren't they?
That was a great moment for Shan's character in the film. I thought it showed you know, her sharpness and her, I'm a way to do this, right? And she marched like an actual woman on a mission, because she was. It was great.
Yeah, that was, and again, you know, in working class communities, everybody's met a woman like Shan, like,
yes,
just sort of would walk yeah. through a brick wall yeah. for our neighbours, and then to find out like later that she becomes an MP.
I found that really interesting. I also didn't realise that the reason why the Labour Party ended up supporting LGBT rights is because of the National Union of Mine Workers, and I wouldn't have expected that. I found I suppose it makes sense. Also, like, I mean, I've known like people that come from a mining background, like originally my mum's family did, because you're like down the pit with those people for like day in, day out. And like, you could die. One of my friends like explained it to me, like, you know, because his dad was a miner, like during the miner strike, and like, you know, if you're in the pit with somebody, like, you're sort of day in, day out, and like, you could die, like, you can't really afford anyone to like break the solidarity.
Well, that's it. I mean, like, you know, if somebody breaks a strike, you know, there's there's not a lot of ways, you know, to get back at somebody like that. So one of the only ways is, well, you've got to make sure they're remembered as a Scabin.
And it's true with the Scabin too, really, of Maureen was the character that was, you know, prejudiced towards lesbians and gays. And she was essentially, you know, banging the drum for her two sons as well, who obviously uh-huh. turned at the end as well, which was really positive. But, you know, another form of Scabin is, you know, using the same media that's bashing uh-huh. the strikes to, you know, coerce her two sons and then report. You know, this solidarity that was being expressed to the media, and then, you know, to expose them and to undermine their efforts. And you could see there where Maureen, by doing that, was actually siding with the police as well, because the police were using mm-hmm. that to undermine the strikers and to try and turn them against each other. So I think, you know, the whole idea of Scabin is, and it's really good, because throughout Pride, there's loads of parallels made between the workers' movement and solidarity and strikes and scabs essentially too, but a lot of that is sort of related when it comes to the media and queer liberation too. So I think that's what is also done really well throughout the film.
It's interesting because Maureen, I mean, mm-hmm. I don't necessarily like her, but I found her a very interesting character, because like it doesn't go into like whether she had any like religious beliefs or anything like that, but like she obviously was very, she came across as being very afraid, mm-hmm. and like very, found it like very hard to like let go of her beliefs. I would have liked to actually like seen more, like, you know, like where she was coming from, because it was, I suppose that she also kind of like felt rejected or something. I don't know, because you know, when she's saying, like, when Cliff came and spoke to her, and she was like, oh, you know, we know how hard you work, you know, but you need to like come and meet these people, and like, mm-hmm. I don't really know what her motivations were. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more like of an explanation of that.
I think when Cliff went to her, Cliff was her brother-in-law, that's right, yeah. isn't it? Yeah. And
the husband died.
Yeah, I think that wee speech she did gave a wee bit of insight in her. You know, she's brought up her two sons herself in a mining village where she's probably skinto. But she came across to me like a bit of a Tory, you know, one of those sort of working class, I'm a wee bit better than the rest of you type attitude.
And I think we were saying that these characters are actually quite well realised, and I completely agree with you, Rachel, that it would have been good to know where maybe she ended up, or you know, what her main drivers were. But I think that, see, in any other sort of film that doesn't necessarily either understand the dynamics in a working class community, or just wanted to write an LGBT story for the sake of doing it, would have made Maureen's character quite powerful in a way. So perhaps being wealthier, perhaps being, I don't know, have some power over these individuals, because that would have been an easier way.
She was on the strike committee, though, with the, in the village. So she obviously supported the strike. But it's interesting. I mean, was she just maybe a little bit conservative in her views, or like, because those characters kept on saying, like, you know, all of this is like a distraction from the strike. So maybe like she kind of felt, maybe she was like worried about like the perceptions of people outside that would have like been even more prejudiced against them. I don't know.
I think she is quite a kind of tragic character. It kind of shows you how isolating bigotry can be.
Bigotry rots your brain, basically.
Yeah, well, it's like Deborah said, like, there's that scene where he talks about, like, she obviously lost her husband when her kids were fairly young, and they get the impression. So she's, you know, had to struggle, and she raised her sons alone. And does she feel, I mean, there's obviously some kind of prejudice, but then there's a lot of characters that have some prejudice that sort of overcome it. But does she maybe feel like she's getting pushed out? And if that committee and that sort of wee sense of responsibility and power was what she felt or she had left, and she was losing that, and she reacted out to double down in her prejudice and her hatred, which then just isolated her further. And in that scene when Cliff's like talking to her, and you see her sort of melt like a wee bit, because she's this quite a kind of hard front on, and you see a wee bit of emotion. And just at that moment, another character goes by and shouts, gives her some abuse, let's say, and you're miserable or something like that. And you just see immediately the defense go back up, and you think, oh, there was a wee chance there.
Yeah, because she was on the brink of like going along with them, and I actually thought that that's what she was going to do. I actually thought that she was going to go with him. I didn't know what decision she was going to make, but it wasn't the person who gave her some abuse wasn't actually one of the quote-unquote gay people. It was like a young person from the village, like, oh, you've got to stick up your ass or whatever she said.
you just saw, like, she was definitely considering whether she'd decide, which I don't think she made a decision, and then she saw that potential for rejection again, and
the door closed, and she grabbed the newspaper, didn't she?
And again doubled down on her bigotry. And then you've got to think as well, is she lost that relationship with her sons? Because by the end of it, you see that they've given up that kind of hatred. And
yeah.
You think, does that mean if they walked away from their mum now as well, and her bigotry has left her completely alone now?
See, bigotry rots your brain and leaves you sad and lonely.
I really want to talk about the soundtrack, and none of yous want to talk about the soundtrack because it's so amazing. You've got Queen, you've got Shirley and Company, Bronski Beat, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, Pet Shop Boys, Culture Club, Grace Jones, Dead or Alive, Wham, Smokey Robinson. I mean, I could go on and on. The songs are so epic, and I love the way that the music sort of crossed the working class and gay divide. Like, that scene when they're in the social club and they're all dancing, they're saying Welsh men don't dance, and he goes, oh, let me show you then, and, and it comes on, shame, 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 shame on you, you know, that, but like, and then the way that some of them, you know, younger minors, they want to learn to dance to get the woman, and like, I thought that, I was just looking it up, because I was like, is it, why is this not a musical? Like, but it is a musical.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I just looked. It's apparently on Broadway, but it's more of a play than a musical. Because everything, it's Pride the Musical tickets, London box office. But this, you know, the solidarity songs, the Bread and Roses, like there's so many emotive moments that come from the music, and that, I just think it's a great score for a film.
Yeah, the scene where they sing Bread and Roses, like that could bring a tear to my eye, like any point. And again, the point in it, we die and his wife, when they just look at each other from across the room, it just gets me every time. And I don't even know how they both managed just to convey so much. We just like moving their eyebrows a wee bit. It's top acting.
But with that relationship with Di and his wife, because that's not really central in the storyline at all. But still, I think that what is often sort of not necessarily highlighted during the miners' strike was the pressure on women to keep the house going. You know, the finances had completely stopped, and there was a lot of pressure put on women, on you know, looking after children and all these types of things. So I think that was quite nice kind of nod to the support between the two of them, which I thought was really quite nice.
Yeah, it's like they don't spend a lot of time in their relationship, but you just see that one scene and just know that, you know, they're completely besotted with each other. It's lovely.
But like, I liked the scene where they were dancing in the dance hall, and they basically, because what were they had? They had that band called Falling Leaves, which is a kind of like folk band or something. And they were like,
it looked like a country and western band.
Yeah. They were putting, and then they were like dancing along to that, and we're like, yeah, here's our man from Falling Leaves, and then they were putting on their like their own records and stuff. And I just thought it was so amazing, like how they got everyone dancing, and like everyone was having a good time. And like, I've been in those kind of places. Like, it's just, it really was like watching real life rather than watching a film, I thought.
Definitely. And I think
it reminded me of some family weddings.
Yes.
Towards the end of the night.
And definitely that like being in those sort of those clubs, you know, and whether it be the labour clubs or the working men's clubs or all these different types of clubs, I think that definitely is whoever pieced these particular scenes together have definitely been in and around them, as in not just, oh, I'm going to go and observe how people react. They've obviously been involved in that. And the reason that I think is so true is because all of the interactions happen in the kitchen and the working club. And that's exactly what happens.
Yes.
Because the out the front is just for the dancing and the drinking and having a laugh. But all the interaction and the organising and all that kind of stuff happens in the kitchen back of house area. So I think that was very well observed.
How many kitchens have you stood in a social club?
Yeah.
With people exactly like that cast around you. Women doing the dishes and somebody walking about with tray. Like, it's so
somebody else coming
set
in and out with a sweeping brush.
Yeah,
it was written by Stephen Beresford, just to give him a shout out. And I couldn't believe this. Directed by Matthew Warkus, who I can't find a record of him having directed any other film. He's directed a lot of plays. He seems to be a theatre director.
See, that comes across in how the film's put together, because it's very much like it's almost like you could put it into acts all the way through, because there's like, oh, this is the main story of this part and this is the main story of that part. And I think it's very play-like, so I think that definitely makes sense.
I was going to say, I mentioned it before, but that scene when Joe, who's obviously like the audience stand-in, I found it so heartbreaking, because it seemed at one point like his mum, and I mean, certainly like when I, you know, when I came out sort of like in the mid-2000s and stuff, I mean, that was the stuff that she was saying, oh, you know, like it's a very lonely life. You don't know what's, you know, you've got to hide from people, all this kind of thing. Like, you know, even though it obviously had moved on by that point, that was like, obviously some of the things that people in my family were worried about when I came out, and I could really relate to what he was, that kind of attitude. But then I kind of thought that maybe his parents would come round, but they just didn't. They just got worse, and I found that so sad because, like, you know, at the start I kind of thought, well, you know, like that's how it was. Like, a lot of people feel like that, but they would come round. But in the end, she was just so horrible to that Sean, and the woman was like, well, you know, there's a whole village full of people who, like, in Wales think your son's a hero, and she just like didn't want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found that so heartbreaking.
Yeah, it hurt deep for me because the words she used, where she said, oh, it's a lot, are you sure you want this, it's such a lonely life. My gay uncle in Hawaii said that to me on the phone when I was 16, and I was like, what are you talking about? You know, and so when I seen that in the film, I was like, oh man, being a young person
said that those exact words.
And just on that point, that bit where Mark's saying, you know, when they have this epiphany of, we need to use this bad press we've got, we're getting called perverts, we need to own it, and he said, and Joe was all, you know, affronted, like, what? And but they're saying we're perverts. And he said, well, here's a part of your education, young man. Hands up if you've ever been called a name like that. I know. And everybody just went, yeah, we've had that one. And like Brian was saying, those wee touches, they can only come from a sort of a personal experience of that, because it's so hard to explain it in another way, you know, like taking that name and owning it. I liked that as well. So I thought that was great.
That was great. But I just found it so upsetting that she didn't want to know, like, that her son had been like a hero to people and helped people.
A wee bit there about him being only 20 as well, and how that was illegal.
Yes.
Yes.
He was like 21 illegal. 21 illegal.
Yeah, and just actually going to, like, where that, you know, that conversation that you've mentioned about the lonely life and things like that. And it's so funny because sometimes because with the mum, it almost felt like it come from a place of love. It's like, it's almost like, I'm just going to check in. Obviously, there's a lot of ignorance there, as if it's a choice, because we know it's not a choice.
Yeah.
But still, it's like, you know, do you want to come out? Do you want to go through this? Because there is a risk that it's total bullshit, you know, because it's not a lonely life. It's, you know, it's, you can choose to live your life how you want to live it, with a partner, with multiple partners, on your own, it's up to you. And that kind of conversation taking place in the bedroom, and in a bedroom which I can relate to, because all those books were exactly the types of books that were still kicking of my time too. And that bedspread and the terrible wallpaper and the little single bed, and it's just so relatable. And for that conversation to happen there, definitely. But moving on to the introduction of the pits and perverts, and jumping on those words and using them, because these words were snowballed and used as buzzwords, and again, just taking it back to how things are for queer people now, these words are being recycled now as well.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important for the queer community to take words back and reclaim them and make them, you know, what they should actually stand, and joking, and really sort of take them head on, you know. Just very much the word queer being, you know, taken back on and reused as a badge of pride and inclusivity is such a good example of that. But the word queer itself, used derogatory in my experience in Scotland, was never really massively done. I think it's an American thing more so. Mm-hmm. Reclaiming these words, I think, was a really good thing. And like Deborah said, it's about somebody's clearly had experiences of that to point to that, because I think that could have been completely just overlooked.
I mean, as much as we've praised the film for all the characters being so kind of well-rounded, Joe's family, I suppose they don't have time to do that with everything. His family, you don't really get much of them. His dad barely speaks. So that aspect, like, I suppose they're limited by time. They kind of go into everything. And I sort of, it made me think of a link or a parallel between Joe and Gethin. I just wondered if, is Joe at the start of that 16-year cycle that Gethin was on with his parents before 16 years later reconcile?
This is definitely possible, but also I think there's a class thing with Joe as well, because you can see that he obviously comes from not a like a rich family or anything like that, but you can tell that they live in a little established neighborhood, and there's maybe a slight class element to it too, perhaps, where the dad doesn't really speak. But that's, I think that's quite common for a lot of heterosexual dads. I don't know, just to be quiet. But I think you can tell when he goes home versus where everybody else goes home, there's a real difference there, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you definitely get the aspect that the mum particularly is like a kind of hyacinth bouquet social climber. You know, like, you see that scene where she does have concern for her son, and you can tell she does love him in her own way, but that kind of goes out the window when she feels like she's been shown up in front of all these sort of guests at the christening, and that becomes a priority.
Aye, she's definitely in the Residents Association board, isn't she?
And she would have got dragged when that minibus turned up with gay and lesbians plastered on the side. Yeah, I thought was fabulous.
You seen that horror, that horror on her face, and she's like, oh no, I'm a way out. And it was very, very suburban middle class. There was lots of great parallels like that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from the working class streets of Wales to, I really liked that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know if it's ever explicitly stated in the film, but you can just almost tell that not only are they not accepting a sort of LGBT sort of things, but you can tell that they don't support the miners' strike.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think do I know that because it was said at some point.
There was also a kind of patronising thing when the mum, because obviously they can tell that the son was interested in the miners' strike. And she shouted down the stairs, oh, have you seen the news? Such good news that the strike's come to an end. And it was done in a kind of patronising way. Like, oh, your little, your little interest is played off. And isn't that lovely? And it was very much, you know, done like that. Whereas in the Welsh community, it was like a big celebration. And you know, Joe got up and just went straight to Wales. And I think that that's, again, quite a class thing where, you know, perhaps people that weren't entrenched in that struggle would have been like, oh, isn't that lovely? The miners can go back to work now, and that terrible business is over. And that's what I got from that little section with the mum, I think.
She clearly didn't support the strike, or like either didn't support it or didn't understand it, or I mean, they were clearly like from the south of England. And where there's a lot of, I wouldn't say, they didn't really like understand why the strike was going ahead, and like a lot of people would have voted for Thatcher, or just not understood it in any kind of like meaningful way.
A lot of Tories in the south.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from the south of England. I know, like,
you can say that. This, you're allowed to.
We're not also calling you a Tory. It's all right.
No, but I mean, you know, and also just, you can just tell, like, because, you know, the house, like, go into the detail again, but, you know, the houses and, like, the clothes and, like, the way that the road looks and the way the gardens look, and,
It was the mother's haircut and her earrings.
Yeah.
It just made me think Tory.
And the outfit that she was wearing was very reminiscent of Kevin and Perry's mum. Like, you know, Kevin from Kevin and Perry. It was exactly the same outfit that the mum wore in that. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to mention that bit because that's also like Joe, who it's almost like his final form. Like, he's this kind of shy, sort of unsure about his cell boy at the start. But then when he's accepted who he is, it's like he develops that sort of cutting gay tongue that he's sort of like, and that tight perm does not suit you. Never did.
A bit sassy.
Yeah, and he definitely becomes quite sassy at the end, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And do you know what as well? Like, and this is something that I noticed when I was watching it today, right? That he's got the same sort of, see the way that Owen Jones talks. He talks the same way as Owen Jones, and he reminded me of Owen Jones for some reason. I think it's just because he looks like him, but it reminded me very much of Owen Jones. I don't know why.
Does look like Owen Jones, actually.
He does.
I noticed that, but it does look
now,
like
now him. You've mentioned it.
I also found it quite sweet when he was like, when he was in bed with Steph, and then like,
yes.
And because I kind of like, when his character was introduced, I actually thought that at the end it was going to turn out that he was straight all along, and he was just kind of like got mixed up into it all somehow. But like, you know, he actually, like, when he's like lying in the bed with Steph, he was like, oh well, you know, like if we were normal, this is the bit where we kiss.
Yeah.
And I just thought it was quite sweet.
And it's such a, I think that's something that is queer people that I can really relate to as well, because I've got, you know, two best friends who are women, and it's like, in another world, if I wasn't gay, then I probably would have married one of them. Do you know what I mean? So it's like, it's really interesting that played out too. And I think that showed real deep understanding of the complexities of queer friendships and relationships too.
I remember watching that scene. It is a nice scene, but for a second I thought, they're not actually going to kiss, are they? Because I thought, that's going to undo a lot of the sort of themes we've been building for 2 hours.
Or they could have been pansexual, they could have been bisexual, so it wouldn't have.
And then in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, is there another alternative cut for like the Alabama market or something like that? But they decided they were better off doing what the Bible says.
Apparently, in the American version of the DVD, obviously the film was still the same, but like they took out any reference to like gay and lesbian in the American market of the film. They were just like London-based activists go and help a Welsh village. And obviously, like, if you watch the film, then you'll know that it's what it's about. But like, I just found that quite funny.
Yeah, I think it was like the DVD cover is like them at the demonstration. Yeah. They've got signs, but in the American copy,
they photoshopped out, changed
the signs so that it wasn't quite as obvious what they were protesting about and things like that.
There's a great scene that shows the broad diversity of the gay scene when they're in the nightclub, and you see, and they're panning round all the sort of minors dancing, we straight people, you know, that are just in for the night, and then you've got, you know, the shirtless guys and their sort of suspenders, and then they go to the two women, Shan and I think it's Maureen, and they've got pints, and they're standing in between this guy. There's a guy in the middle, and he's got a ball in his mouth with a harness on, it's just really subtle wee things that you're like, I've been in that nightclub.
Because the way that sort of queer sort of venues are now, that they are very much like that, and I think that particularly like women, even like heterosexual women, and older heterosexual women generally feel like quite comfortable and relaxed in queer places, and I think that was replicated in the film as well, which I think is really good and very true to form too.
Aye, when the women are going down the stairs to the men's venue, and the bouncer says, "It's a men only venue." And she says, "Ugh, enough of that. We've come all the way for Powiff." Just barged right in. That's great.
The whole sort of compilation of scenes where like the ladies of their night out in London's just hysterical. Like when she's quizzing the guy about how he gets into his leather outfit and things like that.
also the scene where they find the dildo on the bed and they're like, have you seen anything like this?
I remember the stunting so funny in that scene.
She's good.
She's like the porn mag and going,
and she's like waving it around and being like,
that takes me back.
But she is every woman, isn't she, really? Like, you know, after a night out and
when the shackles are off.
Yeah, exactly. It was great.
Right off, there's also that really sort of emotional scene that sort of foreshadows Mark's death, like when in the middle of all the sort of hilarity, he bumps into, I think it's implied that it's his ex-boyfriend, who's in his farewell tour. And again, I don't think it explicitly states, but certainly by the end of the film, you sort of piece together what that was all about. And it's, again, it's just the sort of mix of hilarity and real sort of emotional hammer blows in the film is just spectacular.
It was that sort of undercover conversations that were being done. Like, nobody ever wanted to come out and say it, because I know a lot of people. I mean, I lived in London for 6 years, and I know people that have have been HIV positive, and you know, obviously much, much later on. But there still was that stigma and that shame that was carried, that they could never come out and say it outright. It was always like, oh, you know, this is how I am now, this is how I live my life. And I think that particularly in the hostility of the 1980s, which is, you know, a completely different dimension, is that was very played out quite sympathetically and authentically as well. And it was almost like it was left for the viewer to connect the dots, although it was kind of obviously painted out, but it was never actually said outright until right at the very end that he was HIV positive and died of AIDS complications.
Yeah, and particularly at that sort of point in time, it was still a death sentence. It's not like now where people live HIV positive, which I still don't know if scientifically it's ever been explained how Jonathan, who is still to this day, is still alive. He's been HIV positive for nearly 40 years.
Yeah, he said it was the grass, so...
Yeah, I don't know if that's been scientifically proven, though.
Yeah, I'm going with Jonathan. I think it was the weed. I think that the whole HIV, that underlying story about AIDS and, you know, the absolute scandal that it was for anybody to have it at the time and the way it was portrayed, again, I know I keep coming back to this realism, but it was, you know, so gritty. It was the way they showed you that advert on Christmas Day on the TV as well. Like,
yeah,
I remember that advert. I mean, I don't even know if I physically should be able to, but I remember that advert. It's the one where they're saying that it was AIDS, you know, and having anal penetration. And then Joe's brother-in-law, he says,
anal injection, anally injected death sentence. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I don't know if I'd seen that before, but there was definitely something really familiar about it.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was just a general style of...
Yeah, maybe that's what I remember.
Specifically that one.
Public health back then was done really scary. Like, even like, you know, if you eat too much sugar, it was like, you're going to die. You know, don't do that. You'll have no teeth left.
Yeah,
you know,
it was
really ominous and almost scary. But I think that when it comes to the AIDS crisis, and particularly the time during the AIDS crisis, but also the minor strikes, so you're talking 83, 84, you know, into 85, that... when these campaigns were running, the amount of misinformation that was coming about. So they knew even then that it was only transmitted through sex between two men or somebody who was infected and whatnot. And, you know, there was still the misinformation of, oh, can you share a glass of water? And can you use the same utensils? And, you know, silly things like this. And yeah, that whole campaign is something that I find really wretched.
Like, just before where Gethin gets beaten up and he's, like, still out collecting for the miners and these gay people who are like, no, like, haven't you heard all the gay people are dying? Like, you know, why do you care about the miners so much? Like, look what's happening. And I just thought, like, I found that really interesting as well. And the whole, like, kind of, like, the undercurrent about AIDS, like, kind of, like, going through the film is just, like, it's really sad.
Yeah, it's like we've sort of said at different points, that sort of realism. It's like, that's not what they're saying. Like, this isn't what this story's not really about that, but we're not going to pretend it wasn't there. You know,
as much as that isn't
the story we're telling, it is part of the world that the story takes place in.
I think the only thing that's missing from the whole realism of this film is the consideration of people of colour. I don't think there's much representation of people of colour, which is my only real criticism of it. And the transness and the non-binary and gender non-conformity is only really implied in little bits throughout, so it's not really brought to the forefront. But
a background, sort of characters and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that that would be my only criticism of the whole looking at the realness, because I think that particularly in London and particularly at the time, because, you know, you had the surge of Britain First and all that type of thing, that I think that could have been incorporated into it a little bit more, just to really set the scene a bit more, particularly in London and the South. But other than that, like, you know, the undercurrents of all these real, really important issues was included.
And I think in the great tradition of the film overall, how it brings you up in nice highs and then takes you down really low, that sort of escalated right through to the end, right up until that final great act, I suppose you want to call it, rather than a scene.
Where you just cry.
Yeah, where you can't stop crying. you can't help it. The tears were literally streaming down my face. And they're at the Pride and they're arguing with the lesbians about what banner to carry. And the thing that made me laugh so much about that was, I know lesbians exactly like that. Do you know what I mean? That are all about empowerment and really want to be strong, but they'll also fight you about it.
The ones who are like, oh, well, you know, we shouldn't have any political banners. Let's just keep politics out of it.
This is like a celebratory thing. It's a celebration.
That was real as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's very relevant these days as well.
And when that wee bus came over, this first, like, there was, again, it was like waves of emotion because you were like, oh, that was brilliant. And oh, it's so sad. And then it was just, I don't want to say the very end scene. I'll let somebody else say it. I'm too excited about it.
Yeah, but no, you're right about the way it's like the different sort of points, because you've got the initial, the wee minibus arriving and, you know, like Gwen getting off and we're vegan-friendly baking produce that she's made from, and Di's got his Pits and Perverts t-shirt and things like that, and and then there's the next point when the wee organiser comes in and he says, oh, you're only to go front, there's too many, and there's that moment of confusion, and Di just goes, I think he's talking about them, and again tears streamed in my face when all the buses are arriving and he's reading out all the different branches that have turned up, and it's like I've got tears in my eyes and I'm thinking, I don't know if I'm crying because it's because I'm sad or because I'm happy, but there's just so many emotions that it's just overspilling, you know.
I think it's a real joyous, and you know, pardon the pun, but it's like, you know, it's a real pride moment, really, because you're like, you know, that this is like the solidarity in its rawest, most organic form, and I think that that's what's so uplifting, and it does make you want to cry because you're like, this is so nice, particularly in the context and the backdrop of everything that's happened, and that initial struggle for the miners is passed, so the miners' strike is ended, and that's sort of shifted forward, and they're throwing their weight behind solidarity for the queer liberation, and I just think it's just such a heartwarming and tear-jerking moment, which is just lovely. And then, you know, it gives you the kind of next point of where these characters went on to afterwards, and some really surprising ones. Like, you know, Shan was, the first time I seen it, I didn't see that coming. And he's like, that's such a nice, like, practical, it's almost like we talked about earlier with the solidarity and the practical solidarity. It's like, you know, she went on to university because somebody told her to go to university, didn't they? They said, you're really bright, you need to go to university.
Jonathan.
And she went and it just starts off by saying she went to this uni, she'd done this degree in Welsh languages. And then, you know, but then it goes to, I think it was Swansea East that she was elected, and she was the first woman to represent that area. And it's just such a nice thing that she would have played an instrumental part in the sort of bringing the queer liberation into Parliament. It's just such a positive and nice thing. And then the National Union of Miners being the sort of the final push to get gay and lesbian rights on in the manifesto and on the statute book was just a nice end to it, I think.
There's that point in the conversation between Jonathan and Shan where the strike's over and she is just ready to go back to the kitchen and just gone back to being a housewife, and it needed somebody for the outside of sort of her culture, like Jonathan, to say, like, don't be ridiculous, there's you know, you've got a top class mind, you need to go and use it. And you just wonder if that conversation hadn't happened, would her life have turned out totally different?
Yeah.
Also, in amongst the ending, there's also that other wee sort of bit when Maureen's son gets off the bus. And you just think it's like the final redemption of all that bigotry. Like, can you see how seething with hate the two brothers were when they storm into the miners' welfare earlier in the movie? Then he's getting off the bus and shaking hands with this big, tall, trans woman.
And it's fabulous. And I think that I hate that word as well. And I just said it without even thinking.
Fabulous.
Fabulous. I really hate that word. Anyway, but yeah, I think, like you're saying, they were so angry all the time. And I think it shows people that you can unlearn that anger and you can unlearn whatever it is that you've been taught, because ultimately it is taught, you know, through various different ways to hate different people. And that can be unlearned. And I think that the message that people can take away from this film, that can be applied to any class struggle, to any struggle that's happened just now. So whether that be Black Lives Matter, whether that be refugees trying to flee to this country, and, you know, governments, conservative governments will try and other people and pit them against each other. But if there is solidarity across all the different minorities, actually, you can bring around positive change and you can take on the powerful and the elite.
One of the things I found interesting, one, you know, when the homophobic people were like saying why they shouldn't have the gay and lesbian like support, and they were like, oh, well, you know, what will the men think of it? What will the miners think of it? And actually, like, the miners didn't really have an issue with it, but they were like, oh no, you can't have this, like, you know, you can't have what all the men think, you know, they're associated now with perverts. And actually, like, obviously, like, they all turned up at the end, like, in droves from the miners union. And I just kind of like thought, well, you know, it really kind of shows the power of, like, you know, someone, it was all like so concerned with, like, keeping up appearances rather than mm-hmm. and that was a huge part of what lay behind it.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because it reminded me, I thought I had when I was watching it, was like, how many times in the film did you hear characters say, I don't have a problem with gays?
Mm-hmm.
And it was always like they were always making allowances for the real or perceived prejudices of other people.
Yes.
And it just shows you, like,
what will other people think? Yeah. I don't have a problem. What will other people think? Yeah.
And if you keep doing that, all you're really doing then is creating a safe space for prejudice to then grow into.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can you hear my dog? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Can.
I love it.
I'm so sorry.
Okay. Right, well, I think we've spoke for quite a length here, so I think we should just kind of sum it up now. You all want to take a turn to sort of give, let's say, marks out of five, or five stars. We'll do it 5 stars. Okay. Brian, how many stars would you give it?
I would give it 4.5 because I really, really enjoyed the film. It's one of my personal favourites. Yeah, I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of the representation of people of colour and some of the other struggles at the time incorporated into the film. But other than that, I loved it, and it will always be one of my favourite films, particularly to watch in Pride Month.
Rachel?
I'd say probably like 4.5 out of 5. Pretty much for the same reason. I did wonder, like, about the lack of trans people in the film and the lack of representation of other things, but I suppose. But apart from that, it was excellent.
Deborah?
I'm giving it 5. I don't care. Oh. no, I do. Obviously, there's representational problems and stuff, but just as a film,
the
complexity of the characters, the grittiness and realism, and the total relatability, it gets 5 stars from me. Go and watch it. Show a little pride.
How about 4? Actually, can I change my rating from 4.5 out of 5 to 4.75? like, so 4 3/4.
We only created this rating 5 seconds ago, so we can do whatever we want with it.
You can run with that.
Yeah.
So,
David, what do you give it?
Well, Deborah, I'm glad you gave it a 5 as well, because I thought the token heterosexual here was going to be the only one that gave it 4 marks. I would give it 5 stars as well. It's just so, its rewatchability is just incredible. There's not many films that can still elicit a sort of emotional reaction upon the 10th or 20th viewing, however many times I've seen it. It still kind of has the same sort of impact now as it did the first time I saw it. So maybe we're setting a high bar here for future film, ungagged film clubs. But
who's going to get the first 1 or 2? It's going to be a total bomb.
Or 0.25.
So it was 5 from me and Deborah, 4.75 from Rachel. So the real question is, Brian, why do you hate it so much?
I don't hate it. But okay. You know what? If I was to give a film 4.75, then it would probably be Muriel's Wedding. So to me, that's just the pinnacles of really, really good film.
Right.
So, you know, we're, it's all relative.
Well, yeah, should we do some name drops of other great gay films right now? I'd like, after you finish watching Pride, which is available on Amazon Prime, know that I'm sponsored by them or anything, there, you get offered up next Stonewall, which I also recommend. It's quite a good film. It's a surprisingly good for not very well-known actors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I noticed that came up at the end. I've not seen Stonewall, so I probably will check that out. I'd probably say Milk is another one that sprung to mind.
Great.
Let's get some parallels in terms of there's the scene with the Truckers Union. They sort of have solidarity with the gay community, and the gay bars refuse to stock whatever beer it was that they're in industrial dispute with. So there's some parallels between that and Pride. But yeah, Milk.
I would like to put forward Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, because
classic.
Now, if you want to talk about fives, yeah, but no, Priscilla's a great one because that's from 1993, and I just think it's such a happy film. but there's so many rawness to it, and that really addresses some of the issues to do with gender, I think, in a sort of more lighthearted way, but in a more realist way, and I really love that film. So get yourself over to Sydney and enjoy that.
Rachel?
I think I'm thinking about, is there one that's called like Boys Don't Cry or something? That's I've seen that. That was really good.
With Hilary Swank.
It was a number of years ago that I saw it, though. I mean, to be honest, I haven't really watched that many films in general over the last few years, and like my attention span's like really gone downhill in the last couple of years. But yeah, that was a good film.
I believe Netflix is rebooting the animated He-Man series, which I loved as a child, and now that I've grown up, it's only since then that I've stumbled on web pages that has pointed out a lot of the gay imagery in it that I was not aware of at the time.
He-Man's quite gay, but not as gay as She-Ra. I was in love with She-Ra when I was wee.
Yeah.
She-Ra's gay.
Very gay.
She-Ra get rebooted a couple of years ago. There was a bit of controversy though, because she wasn't as sexualized, and there was a lot of kind of 40-year-old men upset about this because they always love She-Ra.
Of course,
there was a lot of angry middle-aged white men.
Yeah. I remember reading He-Man and She-Ra comics in like the doctor's surgery, because they would always have them there and always like start looking at them.
Sounds like the best doctor surgery ever.
I want to go with that doctor surgery. I think our podcast was quite successful. I enjoyed.
I was just going to say that. We're finished. We're just kind of into blethering territory here, aren't we?
I know. We like our blether, though.
It's always nice to catch that. I mean, we do, yeah. If we're doing a Hollywood one, it's normally, what, an hour and 20 minutes? But there's at least, there could be 2 hours worth of footage, really.
Oh, Rachel, do you want to plug your podcast while you're here?
Sure. So I've got a podcast called Hidden Wings and Bloodlust, and it's all about ladybirds. Deborah actually sings the theme song for my podcast, and I try and release an episode like every week. And basically, like every so often, I do. And most of the episodes are like just me doing it, but like every month or so, I have an interview with somebody on like a ladybird related topic, and I've got a two-parter episode coming out, I think, hopefully by the end of next week, on the year 1976, where 23 billion ladybirds invaded the UK.
That's a story I want to hear about.
Oh, it's great. The Ladybird podcast is honestly brilliant. I'm always raving about it. I really enjoyed the interview with the director of the Palestine Museum of Natural History. Is that,
yeah,
have I got that right? Yeah. And biodiversity. Yeah. I know there's a full name. And that was so interesting, because these guys are going to work while they're getting, you know, bombed. Like, they're still searching for ladybirds. And there's,
yeah,
I find it very interesting. Guys, yeah, would you like to hear what the theme tune is?
Yeah.
Yes.
Let me get my ukulele.
If we need a sound bank, it's I'm going to go and get my ukulele.
This is so unused to me. I had no idea what they were saying.
Yeah, I mean, so it's Hidden Wings and Bloodlust, if you want to hear.
Oh, my thing isn't tuned.